I'll call the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight for Thursday, April 2nd to order. First, we have some minutes to approve from the March 26th.
So moved. Representative.
Yeah, it is too late. Sorry. So we do have some corrections in the minutes. There's some fours throughout it, so I would ask that the legislative assistant be able to approve the minutes as needed, with deleting the fours.
I didn't understand.
There's some typo thing of fours throughout it, and so if she could just do that as needed, if nobody has any objections, that would be great. Yeah, we're talking about that. Representative Olin, are you going to move the minutes?
I'll move the minutes.
As amended?
As amended.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Okay.
Yeah.
Representative Norton will now go with House File 108. I will move. I will move that House File 108, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. And my understanding is that there is an amendment. Representative Norton?
I believe someone has an amendment. Oh. Representative Cornett?
Oh. Didn't know you wanted to do it now.
Please.
Oh, Madam Chair?
Representative Cornett.
The A7 amendment.
All right. Representative Cornett moves the A7 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like. Either Representative Norton or Representative Cornish, if you would like to talk about the amendment.
Yes, so Madam Chair, this amendment pertains to the racial profiling study in the bill. And I've had a conversation with the author of this original amendment, of this section of the bill, Bobby Joe Champion, the representative, and he has given me the okay to offer this amendment to take it out and consider it a work in progress as we move along here. And the language was difficult and not enough time to massage it to the way we wanted it today. So this, if maybe could House our legal analyst could walk you through the amendment and how it pertains to the actual bill.
Mr. Diebel, why don't we do that, and then we would like to vote on the amendment to get it into the form the author would like.
Madam Chair and members, the amendment simply deletes three sections of the bill that were added at the last committee the bill was heard at regarding the racial profiling study and the participation by law enforcement and data collection.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Norton.
Thank you. And I am going to support removing this. We thought we had come to an agreement. There just was not 100% agreement on all parties about the language. Because we have a two-day turnaround for this committee, there wasn't enough time, as was mentioned by the author of the amendment. And so, rather than hold the bill up, we're comfortable with moving ahead as we originally had it.
All right, sounds good. Representative Mulder, do you want to talk prior to putting the bill in the form the author would like?
Well,
or can we vote on the amendment to get the bill in the
however
form?
However you want to do it, but it's regarding the amendment.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Representative Mulder.
Okay, Madam Chair and Representative Norton, obviously if the amendment goes on, then it doesn't have to come to civil justice. But some people have been playing games recently and taking off an amendment and then trying to avoid a committee and then putting it on later. So I want assurance from the author that that's not going to happen. If it's taken off so it doesn't go to civil justice, then I want assurance from the author that it's not going to go back on. Otherwise, we're going to call for it in civil justice.
Representative Norton, I know that Representative Mueller isn't going after your intentions of the bill, but...
Well, I would just say that I can say with certainty that the reason this is being taken off is not a game. It is because we did not have agreement with MPPOA, which is what I thought we had reached the other day, and I was not willing to move a bill forward without their support. That is why it is being taken off today. I cannot speak for what the author of the original amendment might do in the future.
Okay.
Well,
with no further discussion,
we'll call for it then, I guess, since we can't get an assurance from the author.
I didn't hear what you said.
I guess that we'd have to call for it then.
The motion.
Well, go ahead. We'll do that at the end.
Okay. All in favor of the A7 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. Division's been called. All those wanting to delete the supporting the amendment, please raise your hand. Can you put your hands up higher? Go. Thank you. And keep them up.
Okay.
Okay. All those in opposition now, please raise your hand. On an 8-6 vote, the amendment is adopted. Representative Norton, to your bill.
Thank you. Because I've been asked to keep a short hearing for you today, we aren't going to show the videos that we have, and I handed out information that I asked each of you to look at prior to coming here today, so I'm not going to repeat all of that, but I will make some opening remarks. Before you is a bill that can save lives, lower health care costs, and empower law enforcement to uphold the law that is already on the books in the state of Minnesota. Year after year, the majority of people killed in crashes are not buckled up. Passing the primary seatbelt legislation, which entails no cost to the state or the public, is the quickest, easiest, most cost-effective way to increase seatbelt use. That has been proven in states that have moved from secondary to primary enforcement seatbelt laws just in the last few years. 27 states now have primary seatbelt laws. First and foremost, primary seatbelt legislation is about saving lives and preventing injuries. But particularly in this economic climate, it is critical to acknowledge the significant health care cost savings that will result from increased seatbelt use. It is believed that we can save an immediate $11 million in hospital charges by passing this legislation, and that savings would be ongoing. A Minnesota study which looked at crash and hospital charge data for the 2004 to 2005 years, showed that unbelted victims have hospital charges that are 60% greater than belted victims, and taxpayers are paying for those unbelted crashes. Government sources, including Medicaid, were charged $42 million a year for unbelted hospital charges in the years covered during that study. These dollar figures are very conservative, as a matter of fact. They only are hospital and emergency room data, and they do not include the cost of specialists, outpatient treatment, follow-up care, injury rehabilitation, or extended nursing and assisted living care. And some of that and additional data was in the packets that I sent to you. I'm not going to go into great detail because I did provide that to you, but a couple other points I want to make is that two-thirds of Minnesota residents agree with law enforcement officers being able to stop a vehicle if occupants are not wearing their seatbelts. There was a Corona Research survey that was done recently. We have a wide range of support, and that also was provided to you in the packets of many, many organizations that support seatbelt legislation. Another important point is one that's aimed at protecting the children in our state. When drivers buckle up, children in their vehicles are buckled up nearly 90% of the time. But when drivers don't wear their seatbelts, kids in the vehicle are restrained only 25% of the time. Primary seatbelt legislation has no downside. It costs the state nothing. It will bring federal incentive funds into our state, $3.4 million, if we get this done by June 30th of 2009. It prevents injuries. It saves an enormous amount of health care dollars, particularly from government payer sources, and Minnesotans want it. Every year that goes by without getting this done results in more deaths, more injuries, and more dollars on health care costs. It is not responsible public policy to know all this and allow us to continue to waste lives and money. We do have some testifiers, I believe. We have the police chief. We have, I think, the commissioner or a representative from the commissioner's office is here.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
John Harrington, Chief of Police of the City of St. Paul. And I'm here today to testify in support of this bill. I believe that primary seatbelt is the right policy, and this is certainly the right time. In fact, it is overdue that we pass primary seatbelt in Minnesota. In my time, 30-plus years of police work, I can count literally hundreds of crashes that I've been at where the occupants of the vehicle would have been saved if they had been belted in. And I can tell you that in large part because we do not have primary seatbelt, there are people who still believe that this is optional and that somehow or another this should be a matter of personal choice. And I disagree with them strenuously. It is my opinion and my experience that when people are not belted in and when we are not able to stop them, that people make really bad decisions, and in this fact will aid in one of the three E's of good traffic enforcement. We need to do education, and we are doing that. We need to do good engineering, and I think we've already done some of that. What we now need to do is take enforcement action so that this happens. In my experience, literally, I can count, you know, even in the last year, crashes, one right up the street from here on Rice Street, where we literally had child launched out of the car, and because they were not belted in, the child was crushed by the car when it tipped over. I've been in a lot of crashes with rollovers. When the kids are belted in, when the adults are belted in, people's lives are saved. This bill will save lives. I really do believe it is an important bill. One criticism that I've heard from some is that they're concerned about this bill having implications about racial profiling. I was the chair of the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives Minnesota chapter for a number of years. NOBLE is the Black Police Chiefs organization. And for as long as I can remember, NOBLE has been a supporter of primary seatbelt. The black police chiefs all over this country know that primary seatbelt is a good policy, that it does not increase racial profiling, and none of the studies that have been done in states where they have primary seatbelts indicate that racial profiling goes up, and in fact, just the opposite. In states where primary seatbelt has become the law, more black motorists buckle up, which is a concern to black chiefs of police, and racial profiling and tickets simply based on racial profiling go down. So I do not believe that this bill will have any implications on racial profiling. I do believe it will save lives, and I do believe it is a good policy.
Thank you. Next testifier, please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Michael Campion is my name. I'm Commissioner of Public Safety. I won't bore you with the information that you folks already have. I do have a couple thoughts that I'd like to offer this morning. We are never going to be able to prevent or eliminate car crashes, but we do have an opportunity to prevent some of the needless tragedies that happen on our roadways every day through unbelted crashes. We last year had the lowest traffic fatality rate in Minnesota since World War II. I think legislators and enforcement people can be very proud of that statistic. That is real people's lives who have been saved, families who have been spared, any number of different kinds of tragedies. Certainly gas prices have contributed to that, but clearly enforcement, education, and primary seatbelt, the seatbelt compliance in Minnesota contributes to that. In Minnesota, we have an 87% compliance rate. That is a phenomenal statistic and something that I think we can be very proud of. What that means is 13% of the people driving in Minnesota don't wear a seatbelt. And that 13% accounts for 200-plus deaths a year and about 300 to 400 life-altering crashes that have people end up in hospitals or nursing homes that cost enormous amounts and millions of dollars to Minnesotans every year. 80% of the traffic fatalities that are involved with unbelted crashes occur in greater Minnesota, and a large disproportionate of those crashes are young men. As was said before, I want to reiterate that 75% of Minnesotans think that this should be the law. It's the latest survey in 2000. in 8. We get $3.4 million in federal incentive money to make our highways and roads safer. And I am here to say that, as I have said before, the governor has supported this when he was a legislator, and if it gets to his desk, the governor will sign it. For those that think that this legislation goes too far and reaches too far into people's personal lives, let me offer a suggestion that almost everything that the legislature does when it passes legislation has one of two effects. It either tells people, groups of people, large or small, you must do this or you can't do this. Primary seatbelt focuses on those 700,000 Minnesotans right now, the 13% that do not wear their seatbelts. It focuses on them and informs them that this is an important tool and that they must wear their seatbelts. This is not an enforcement gimmick or gadget. This is about our opportunity across the spectrum to send some messaging out that primary seatbelt is an important tool and to get that compliance rate somewhere between 95 and 97%. Lastly, I have a quote here from Lee Iacocca, who said, "Not using seatbelts raises our taxes, increases our insurance rate, and harms our loved ones. If that's not an intrusion on my freedom, I don't know what is." So with that, I'd ask for your support for the bill.
Questions from members? Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is my police chief still in the room, or did he leave? That figures. Okay. Well, I then have a question, maybe for Representative Norton or my good friend, the commissioner. I was listening to NPR this morning, and I heard the rates of sexually transmitted disease statistics have doubled. Namely, chlamydia annually is about a 4% increase, and we're at like 7% increase this year. Now, statistically, we know that by using condoms, protected sex, you decrease the rate of transmission, which obviously is public health and saves people's tax dollars and medical dollars. Would you, if you support the intrusion into our cars to take away personal freedoms on the basis of public health, would you support police officers entering our bedrooms just to make sure that people are taking care of business responsibly?
Anyone want to answer that question?
I assume that question was for Representative Norton.
Either or. I mean, it was sort of rhetorical, but I think it's legitimate. I kind of do want to know where it ends.
Your police chief came back.
I've got a different question for my police chief.
Representative Norton, you can choose to answer that question or you can choose not to answer that question. Who can...
Well, I'm not sure I'll answer it directly, Madam Chair, but I will just say I do think there is a fine line when government has a role and when it doesn't have a role. And I think this does not cross that line, which is why I brought the bill before you today.
Good answer. Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was a legitimate question, whether it made people uncomfortable or not. This is the line where we have to decide where government crosses. And people have made the decision that this public health issue is enough for us to cross the line. My question for my police chief is, Chief Harrington, if I tell you on the record right now that I don't wear my seatbelt, could you pull me over?
No.
Chief Harrington.
Okay. Representative Ledge, and Chairman, no, I don't believe that I could pull you over simply on your testimonial.
Okay.
Representative Ledge.
I just wanted to check and be sure. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table. Please come to the table. Please, if you want to testify for or against the bill, please come to the table. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Janet Triandafilizu, and I am against this bill, and I will explain why. In 57 years, I've had three accidents. All three were either sideswipe or T-bone. In each case, if I had been wearing a seatbelt, I would have been killed or seriously injured. The first time was in a car. I was T-boned on the center post, and the armrest hit my hip. The impact threw me to the passenger side. I was able to hang on to the steering wheel and pulled over to the side. The second time, car, the front post was hit. And my head hit the inside of the center post, which at that point was not padded because the wrecker company had pulled out the door. Had I injured my head, I would have probably been a vegetable or dead. As it was, that impact, again, threw me to the passenger side. This last time, which occurred 2 years ago, I had a passenger in my truck. The truck was T-boned on the passenger side, total. Had she been belted in, she would have been seriously injured. As it was, she hit me in the shoulder, and I had sore ribs in the shoulder for a few days. Otherwise, she would have been either hurt or killed. And of course, my truck was total. But children, yeah, should be belted in, because we do stupid things. But I've been driving for 57 years, and three accidents, all side swipes. I do not have experience with front end or rear end. I can see where a seatbelt would help. But based on my experience as either being side swiped or T-boned, that it should be my choice. Are there any questions?
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, please, if you want to testify, please come so I can see you, because otherwise we're going to be moving right along. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam members, my name is Gary Fincell. I'm from Prior Lake. I've lived in Minnesota all of my life for 42 years. In that time as a courier in outstate Minnesota, I've logged over 2 million miles. And as far as primary offense seatbelt legislation, I don't think it's a good idea. Not only is it not a public safety issue, but I think it is a public safety hindrance. I would rather have law enforcement out there pulling over the drunk driver, the reckless driver, the excessive speeders that actually are an actual threat to the public safety of Minnesotans than the unbuckled motorist. Now, it's been stated by radio talk show hosts, members of the legislature, that we are the nanny state, the state where absolutely nothing is allowed. Primary offense seatbelt legislation is another example of just how the Minnesota government seems to portray itself on many Minnesotans. About 20 plus years ago, the Minnesota legislature initiated a seatbelt law. And the way they got it passed was they said, well, don't worry, we'll just make it a secondary offense and there won't be any fine, there won't be any teeth. And so that convinced enough members to actually pass the seatbelt law in the first place. And then the legislature told Minnesotans, well, we're going to put a little teeth into it and put, I think it was a $10 fine onto it. And then over the years as it progressed, I think we're up to $75. And now, over the last 10 years, including House File 108 here, we want to push a primary offense seatbelt law. A lot say, well, it's already law, let's enforce it. I would like to see the Minnesota legislature keep its promise of 20 plus years ago and say, yes, go ahead and we'll just keep it as a secondary offense on moving violation. As far as the policy on the roads and law enforcement and what it dictates to the citizens, we don't ban motorcycles on the roads. We don't even have a helmet law. I've been eyewitness to a couple of accidents involving motorcycles, one on I-35 in Lakeville, Apple Valley, and another down in South Owatonna in County 45. I'm no expert, but I would say that those individuals on motorcycles that were killed might have fared better if they were in an automobile. But I'm not here asking for banning motorcycles.
and I'm also here asking you not to have primary offense be bail bond. In conclusion, and to reiterate, it is a personal responsibility to issue the seatbelt. It is a good idea, but good ideas do not make for good law. I would like to just have law enforcement protect me from those that could do me harm. Members, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Cornish.
Unless there's any other testimony.
I don't see anyone else, Representative Cornish. We're going to proceed. Questions from members.
Madam Chair and members, I want to give you a short bit of comments followed by a true story. It's not a big graphic horror story or anything, but there'll be members that will come up here to the table and we could forward them up and they'll tell you stories about people that were trapped and drowned underwater because of the seatbelt, or they were trapped and burned because of the seatbelt. But we could fill the room and probably the whole Capitol with relatives told of stories how many lives were saved by seatbelts. And for those of you, a lot of you like gambling, this is about the worst way to gamble with your life that there is, or your kid's life. And to give you an idea of how it's so important is, you might want that personal freedom, but I guarantee you once you have kids and you're out late at night and they're 16 years old, you're going to want them to have one extra incentive to have that seatbelt on, because there are numbers of stories where your kids could have wore the seatbelts, and families can tell you this, but the kid sitting next to them wasn't wearing their seatbelt, and in the accident, the kid came over and killed one. Your child that was being legal and wearing the seatbelt. Highway 46 near South of Squaw Lake, north of Deer River. People came down the road. The passenger was wearing a seatbelt. The car was turned sideways in the snow. It was hit. The passenger came over and killed the driver. It's just a blatant fact that seatbelt saves lives. And it's the worst way to gamble with your life and your kids' life is not to have one. Just a quick story. I was driving down the road as a conservation officer, looked to the right, and my son, as a state trooper, had a vehicle in the ditch. Went over the vehicle, gone onto the ditch, had deadheaded a tree. To put it mildly, the owner's contents of his head were on the windshield. And didn't have a seatbelt on or it would have saved his life. While we're standing there directing traffic, a number of people came by without wearing their seatbelt. The officer who was visibly shaken by the accident and the death, all he could do was yell at the people, say, put your seatbelt on. He couldn't stop them or anything because it wasn't a primary offense. Just to give you an idea how it affects the public and the stories about the trapped people in these odd cases, the majority, there's nobody that's going to sit here, I hopefully not, and say if you don't wear your seatbelt, you'd be more safer. So I just would urge your support of this badly needed legislation. It's not an intrusion into a car. Cops have already 8 or 10 ways they could stop you, for a driving violation. They don't have to pick off this one thing about wearing your seatbelt to use that for an excuse. I mean, there's numbers of violations that could lead you to be stopping, from a tail light out to obscured window, dirty license plate, non-lit license plate, a loud muffler, loud basses in the back seat. I mean, to say that this is an intrusion into your life, I think it's really a stretch, and I would just urge your support for this bill.
Further questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Bingham renews her motion that House File 108, First Committee Engrossment, be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative
Division.
Norton. Division has been requested. All those in favor signify by raising your hand. Those opposed? Raise your hand. The motion prevails 9-6. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
All right, next, Representative Zellers. Is Representative Zellers in the room? No, Representative Zellers is not. So, Representative Lex. Members, Representative West moves that House File 1947 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommended re-referral to the Health Care and Human Services Finance Division. Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Minnesota Prescription, first of all, did I just move it, Madam Chair?
You did.
Okay, thank you. The Minnesota Prescription Drug Program to Prevent Fraud and Abuse Act of 2009 ensures that the nearly 20 million Americans who abuse prescription drugs will have a more difficult time, at least in Minnesota. Now, if I could, I have a couple of testifiers who come up here to That's fine. Are you ready to go? Okay. Madam Chair, members, while illegal drug use has shown a decline in recent decades, prescription drugs abuse for drugs like OxyContin have continued to rise. OxyContin is the most frequently prescribed opiate painkiller in North America and frequently has been compared to heroin. In addition to drug diversion for recreational use and addiction, there is a significant threat related to pure profit gained by diverting prescription drugs, for example, high-cost cancer and AIDS drugs. It's not certain that we'll ever operate on 100% electronic process for prescriptions. There is, as has been stated, there is some opposition because of a movement next year towards going toward completely electronic prescriptions. However, that's not going to be 100%. By January 1st of 2011, we will, in this state, fully e-prescribe, but we don't know if the DEA will move to e-prescribe by that deadline for controlled substances. We need a program to in place to ensure we are taking steps to prevent prescription fraud before 2011 and after 2011 in the cases where electronic prescriptions cannot be used. I have with me, why don't you just introduce yourself for the record?
Sure thing.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is John Harden. I represent the Standard Register Company. I've spent over 22 years in document security and am a certified document security expert. I consult with state governments, agencies, organizations across the country on this very topic. And I'm here today just to help support your analysis of this approach and answer any questions that you may have. What I'd like to do is give you just a very brief overview of the issue, some of the savings that you might incur here in your state, and then best practices that I see across the country as far as addressing this issue. First, from an overview, I think an overview of the addiction side has been shared with you very nicely, as well as the effort for profit. I think the abuse we all see on TV, we read about and hear about movie stars, radio, TV, and other people that get the highlights. So we know of some of the addiction. What you may not have heard about, unless you study the issue, is the appeal to our youth. When I was growing up, prescription drugs were not a big issue. There was a little bit, but today there are what's called farming parties. The price of admission to a farming party for our youth is pills. You come with certain kinds of pills, whatever you can get your hands on, that gets you into the party. They're poured into a bowl or a bag, and then you reach in and you take a blue one, a green one, a red one, whatever the case might be, and see what happens. Terrifying for a father, I can tell you, to think about that. Hard to imagine that it's true. When you study these statistics, when we survey our youth, what we find out about is that the reason they're willing to partake of this type of activity is they believe the drugs are safe. Mom and dad take them, the doctors prescribe them, the pharmacists dispense them. They're approved for use in the country by our by the DEA. So it's that type of belief that they're safe and can't harm them that leads them to this type of activity. Here in Minnesota, just in 2007, your Department of Health and Human Services did a study that looked at just two counties, and they found that there were 106 opiate-related deaths, up from 96 deaths in 2006, and that compares in those two counties to 70 cocaine deaths and 13 deaths involving meth. So what you don't hear a lot about is the amount of the problem related to prescription drugs. It's a very quiet epidemic that we have not seen. Okay, we'll do. I'll quickly move on. Two other points. I wanted just to dig into the profit side briefly and then into the best practices. The profit side, just to give you an idea, beyond the abuse, people go after it from the money, which creates a lot of the demand and whatnot. Do you want me to touch on any of the profits or move straight on to the best practices?
Members, I have asked Representative West to ask the testifier to get to the sections that are within the jurisdiction of this committee. So we need to talk about the criminal portions and the parts about penalties. This is going to health, and so we'll leave the health thing to the health committee.
Very good.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. Let me jump to the crime side of it then. It's a profit-motivated side. And to walk through the dollars real quick, if you look at Lortab, 7.5 milligram, the pharmacy acquisition cost is about 6 cents. They buy it for 6 cents. On a $15 copay, The patient is going to spend about 47 cents per pill for that particular drug. The street value nationally is about $5. Last week I spoke with an emergency room nurse here in your state, and she shared with me that what she is hearing from some of the drug-seeking patients is more like $25 per pill. So you can see, spend $15 for a bottle of pills, sell them on the street for between $5 to $25 a pill, and I can get, that's about a 967% return on my investment. Better than I can do anywhere else, I can assure you. When I look at, a national study was recently done, 2007, the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud did a study and came up with an estimate of $72 billion a year lost to due to prescription drug diversion costs to all insurers. That's nationally. So what I did was to try to bring that into a Minnesota number. I looked at what percent of healthcare spend nationally Minnesota represents. That's 1.9%. And based on that, pulling the number out of that same study, that equates to approximately $1.4 billion lost in this state to insurance providers, whether that's Medicaid, Medicare, Blue Cross Blue Shield, whoever the case might be, extrapolating that. What I then did was looked at the success of another state. New York implemented a program similar to the one in your bill back in 2006. And we've got third-party documentation out there that you can look at. They saved $140 million first year on their program. So by extrapolating their success based on number of prescriptions issued, Medicaid spend, and some other factors, and I can share in greater detail if you like, potential savings for this bill in your state is between $15 and $30 million savings. And we can share that kind of analytics with you when appropriate.
Thank you.
Last thing, very quickly, I think you've got a package in front of you, and you should have a sample of a another prescription. What I see across the country, if you want to think about three ways of looking at this, and I think your bill takes care of it, to address this problem of drug diversion, prescription drug diversion, that is to simplify the prescription pathway, secure the pathway, and then validate it at the point of sale in the pharmacy. So simplification means that you move away from today, in almost every state, you have whatever the physician decides is the prescription that they want. Blue ones, green ones, red ones, blank white on copy paper they can use. That makes it very difficult for frontline pharmacists when I speak to them. How do I know if it's a real prescription versus a counterfeit or not? So if you come up with, as your bill requires, a single format, then both the prescribers, the patients, and the pharmacist will know this is what it's supposed to look like. So you simplified it, then you add security features to it, similar to the ones required by Medicaid currently, to protect it against counterfeiting, copying, alterations, and theft. And then you validate that prescription at point of sale in the pharmacy with automation.
Thank you. Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience? Oh, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Mr. Lesh, or Representative Lesh, or to the testified, does the Board of Pharmacy support this bill?
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. There, actually, we do have an individual here from the Board of Pharmacy who maybe will ask some of the questions. I forget his name, Madam Chair, but he's in the audience. Hello?
Board of Pharmacy, are you present in the room?
I guess he's not. Okay.
I believe that there is someone here from... from the Minnesota Medical Association. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, go ahead, and please keep in mind that this is the Public Safety Committee and not the Health Committee.
Will do, Madam Chair, appreciate that. Committee members, my name is Sarah Nosnacki. I represent the Minnesota Medical Association. We are happy to just be going to the Health Care Committee to the public safety components of the bill. We agree that abuse and diversion is a very important concern when it's related to prescription drugs. But there are a number of activities already going on in the state and nationally that are directed at those activities, both by the Board of Pharmacy, our e-prescribing efforts that you've heard about, and a program called NASPER. So we'll continue to get the nuts and bolts of this, I think, in the healthcare committee, but I wanted the committee to understand that there are a lot of drug, just anti-drug diversion activities going on in Minnesota already.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, isn't the federal government already on top of this as far as the tamper resistance and all this that's in the bill that you're talking about? Don't they already require that from...
Mr. Hardin?
Thank you. A very good question. Actually, a first step has been taken, and I think very much in favor of the fact that they have, on a federal basis through Medicaid, require tamper-resistant prescription pads for any Medicaid prescription. And they specifically require, if Medicaid is going to pay for it, you have to have three security features. Not just three features, but one specifically for protection against copying, one for protection against alterations, and one for protection against counterfeiting. So they've raised the conversation, but I think this bill gives you an opportunity to improve on the practice. Let me give you an example of what is faced out there. So as a prescriber, you have to know whether or not it's a Medicaid patient or not, or might become a Medicaid patient, whether or not to use the tamper-resistant pads, or you carry one pad for everybody. That is one option. As a pharmacist, you now have to become a document security expert. And I can share these with you, but this is the conversation that I have with frontline pharmacists. One of the common features on a prescription to protect against photocopying is a photocopy void, to where if you make a photocopy of the prescription, the word void would show up on the copy. And a pharmacist asked me when the implementation of the CMS bill came out, he asked me, he said, John, how am I supposed to validate if it is tamper-resistant for copying? And do I have to keep a photocopier next to my cash register in order to validate that features it? Wow, great question. We offer over 100 security features, of which a physician could choose any of. And then you have to get down to, I could pick five security features, but all five of them protect against copying. It still would not be CMS compliant because I need one of each of the three. So pharmacists are now put at the front line of this to scrutinize the prescription rather than making sure it's the right drug for the right patient and the right milligrams. Now we're asking them to become document security experts. And I can tell you that gets very difficult. When you read the articles coming out of New York and their program and other states that are looking at this and talking to pharmacists, what they really like is a single version that they can glance at like a $20 bill. We're all very familiar with what a $20 bill looks like versus blue ones, green ones, red ones, you know, what's it supposed to look like. When you issue one version, then it gets very easy for them. So the feds have taken a step, but the practice of implementing it in the state has gotten actually a little bit more confusing, in my opinion.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair and Mr. Hardin, how does law enforcement play into this as far as if a pharmacist has got a prescription and it's a dummy or it's something that's not proper, where does law enforcement come into play? How does the pharmacist, does he contact law enforcement, or is there like a bank robber, you got a button, you just hey, we got a bad guy here, a bad person that's trying to get drugs on the, where's the connection there?
Mr. Hardin.
Great question. And I smile because I've had some interesting suggestions brought out, but I'll stick to your bill. Nothing in your bill changes how you handle that process today. Whatever you are asking of your pharmacist today, if they suspect fraud at the counter, they would handle it the same way. It would change nothing except make it easier for them to look at the prescription and decide whether or not to fill the prescription. And in fact, if you implement the automated validation in the pharmacy, they would actually be told, do not fill, this is a reported loss or stolen prescription. So it would tell them not to dispense. What you as a state decide to do as far as asking them to go a step beyond would be something either you already have in place or would be an issue for debate at a later date with a different topic. So it would not change current practice, I don't believe.
Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative West renews his motion that House File 1947 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Health Care and Human Services Finance Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Representative West. Representative Winkler. The Chair moves that House File 7 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Representative Winkler, I believe we have two author's amendments. So the Chair moves the A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion carries. The Chair also moves the A6 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This bill comes in part from a bit of citizen outrage, and I was the citizen, last summer when we got reports on the legislative auditor's findings of the DNR conservation officers, as well as, of course, the well-known story of Sonia Pitt. all people who were found to have been misappropriating state funds. What happened to them was they got fired, and that was about it. And under the current law, the legislative auditor can refer cases to the Attorney General's office for them to pursue civil action to get some damages paid back to the state. And they can refer cases to the county attorney for criminal prosecution, but there is no crime defined for misappropriation of state funds. Currently, in Section 16A, it merely states that it is illegal to do so, but it doesn't clarify that there's any criminal, or it doesn't state that there's any criminal sanction. So what this bill does through Section 3 is to clarify that there is a criminal sanction of a gross misdemeanor for intentionally and knowingly spending money for a purpose other than that which it was for which it was appropriated. And Section 4 deals with a suggestion from the legislative auditor on evidence, which is specifically that when state agencies conduct investigations and interview employees, they may be spoiling evidence by not providing a Garrity warning. And so the idea behind Section 4 is to create and to disseminate and emphasize a set of best practices for conducting those investigations so that if there is a criminal charge brought subsequently, the evidence will be preserved to be introduced at trial.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Tamar.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, can you just explain your amendments a little bit?
Representative Winkler, do you want to do it, or do you want me to do it, or what would you like, Representative Winkler?
Madam Chair, it's the prerogative of the Chair to address anything that may come before the committee, and maybe you would want to exercise that.
Okay. The A6 Amendment codified the new section dealing with the best practices for investigations into Minnesota Statute Chapter 16A instead of Minnesota Statute 43A. It was Chapter 43A is the appointing authority is defined to include all three branches of state government, while Chapter 16A generally applies to the executive branch. The amendment addresses this by adding on line 3 by stating that this section applies to all three branches. Then the A3 amendment was an amendment that clarified that the prohibition on the misuse of state funds applies to all three branches of the state government. The last part of the amendment provides that an immediate removal provisions do not apply to judges, constitutional officers, or legislators except as potential grounds for removal in the manner specified in the Constitution.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Tamar, I defer to the Chair because some of this language was suggested by Representative Hillstrom, but the basic intent is to make sure that this applies not just to the executive branch, but that anybody in the three branches of government who misappropriates state funds would be subject to the same penalty, except that it wouldn't preempt impeachment as a or removal from office as a independent and separate recourse.
Follow-up, Representative Tamar? Alright. Further questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the Chair renews her motion that House File 7 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. As amended, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Person prevails. Thank you, Representative Winkler. Representative Zeller, it's my understanding that you are presenting Representative Atkins' bill. Okay, the Chair moves that House File 1719 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. My understanding that there is a author's amendment, so the Chair moved the A090316 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is the Department of Commerce Viatical cleanup bill, and there is one additional oral amendment that is just a couple of lines, a couple of words that the Department has looked at. Everybody's fine with. Came in after Chair Atkins had left, but there's someone here from the department if you'd like to have him explain it before we adopt the amendment. It's just changing.
Why don't you go through the amendment, sure. Tell us where it is. And
sure. On line 4.22, after rule 144, insert the letter A. So it reads rule 144A.
Okay, do members have that? Is that it, Representative?
Yes, ma'am, sure it is.
Thank you. Okay. The chair removed the oral amendment to add the letter A after 144 on page 4, line 4.22. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have the gentleman here from the department, if you'd like to have an explanation of the bill or the sections that apply to the Public Safety Committee.
We would like him to describe the sections that apply to the Public Safety Committee and not the entire bill, Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Manny Munson-Regala. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Market Assurance Division of the Department of Commerce. The section that's relevant to the committee, I believe, is found in under Section 11, Subdivision 1. That would be page 28, lines 28.2 through 28.5. In particular, the section detailing that the insurance fraud, that the commission of an insurance fraud is defined by the bill, is sentenced under the sections dealing with how you sentence insurance fraud.
Question from members. Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill?
I believe we have Houston Valley on the bill, Madam Chair.
All right. The chair renews her motion that House File 1719, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion carries. Thank you, Representative Zeller.
Thank you, MBF Chair Atkin.
Next, we have, who's in the room? Is Representative Hayden in the room? Representative Hayden. The chair moves that House File 1394 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Hayden, I believe you have an author's amendment.
We do.
That it, is it technical, or do you still have the pieces in it that we need to take out, or is it?
It's my understanding that they came out, if that's right.
Mr. Gearing.
Madam Chair, there should be an A4 amendment at the pages.
Okay.
Are either in the process of passing out or?
We do need the amendment to be passed out. So I believe that the amendment is strictly technical now, Representative Hayden. So if you want to talk to the bill as if it's amended, as soon as we get the amendment, we'll adopt it.
I do. I want to, the bill is essentially a problem property bill. As many of you know, we're dealing with a foreclosure crisis all throughout the state. In particular, in Minneapolis, it is, we've been heavily hit. We've had about 3,000 foreclosed properties last year, and we're on pace to get 3,000 foreclosed properties this year. What we want to do specifically with this committee, or in general, the bill really deals with how the city can get in control of those foreclosed and abandoned properties so that we can secure them so that they're not used for nefarious activities.
Representative Hayden, if you could specifically talk to the sections that are within the jurisdiction of the Public Safety Committee, we would like not to open up the entire bill.
Thank you. Appreciate that. We want to deal with the trespassing requirements, or the trespassing posting requirements, which are in, what's the bill? You know, which is on section 13, starts at line 8.13. We have a Minneapolis City Attorney, Lisa Golden, here to kind of help us go through this.
All right. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lisa Golden, and I'm an Assistant Minneapolis City Attorney. The proposal contained in HF 1394, which is supported by the City of Minneapolis, would improve enforcement of the trespass law in three specific ways. First, it would simplify the overly technical and unnecessary restrictions on the type and placement of no trespass signs on construction sites. Second, it would also clarify the requirements for no trespass signs posted on buildings that are not under construction, so general buildings. And third, posting requirements for aggregate mining sites would be modified so that they're consistent with the first two changes that I mentioned. And while these amendments are technical in nature, they would clarify the law in ways that will improve public safety and prosecution. With regard to the construction sites provision, currently the law requires that there are about 7 very cumbersome requirements that construction site owners must post in order to provide that people not trespass on construction sites. They include requirements like that the sign must be 11 inches square, conspicuously posted, placed on the exterior of a building under construction, which is sometimes difficult when a building is actually not present on the site. It's just an excavated site. And other things of that nature. What this proposal would do is to simplify that part of the construction site provision so that it would require conspicuous posting of a general notice warning against trespass. And so that would make it much simpler in cases where there are construction sites that are posted for no trespassing. The second major part of this change is it pertains to general posting of buildings, and that would include things like houses and apartment buildings. Currently, there is no definition of what posted means in that context in the trespassing statute, and what this bill would do is to clarify that posted would be signs that would be 8.5 by 11 inches in size, that they would be conspicuously posted, and that that they would be posted so that people can see them clearly. This is an especially important change for the city of Minneapolis. We had about 3,000 trespassing cases last year alone, and a good share of those, I'd say about a fourth of those, are in cases where houses have been posted no trespassing. And under the current statute, there is no provision that covers that situation, so we use our ordinance instead. And this change would allow that situation to be covered under state statute, and that would make it consistent throughout the state. And then finally, the aggregate mining provision, which is contained in lines 9.10 through 9.12, would be made consistent with those other provisions so that basically the requirements of posting, regardless of where the trespassing is prohibited, are clarified and made consistent throughout the statute.
All right, thank you. The chair moves that House File 1394 be recommended pass and sent to the General Register, and the chair moves the A4 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, questions from members? Seeing none, the chair renews her motion that House File 1394 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Is Representative Champion in the room? Is Representative Johnson in the room? Representative Johnson moves that House File 1457 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Johnson, I believe that you have an author's amendment. So Representative Johnson moves the A090347 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Representative Johnson.
Actually, Madam Chair, I need to make a, now that we have the amendment, did we move the amendment already?
Yep, and we adopted it. Do you need to make a change now, Representative Johnson?
I'll make a change to the bill now that the amendment is on. And that is on page 4, line 2.
Okay, Representative Johnson, is this the strike shall and insert may, Representative Johnson? Because that's what we did in the amendment.
That's correct. And I want to keep the shall on 4.2 and, in fact, replace the shall on line 4.17 with may. That's the correction.
Okay. Representative Johnson, we're going to reconsider the amendment, amend the amendment, and then we're going to readopt the amendment.
Very good. Thank you.
So Representative Johnson moves reconsideration of amendment 0347. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Johnson, now we're going to...
To the amendment, on, Madam Chair, on line 1.4, rather than reading page 4, line 2, it should read page 4, line 17.
Everyone have the amendment, editing the 0347 amendment on line 1.4 changing line 2 to striking the 2 and inserting 17 in its place. Is that correct, Representative Johnson?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. Representative Johnson moves the 0347 amendment as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. Representative Johnson, to your bill.
Madam Chair, members, you'll note that in the what we did with the amendment was delete section 1. So that's no longer a part of the bill. If we move then to section 2, subdivision 3, you'll note that what we did was made possible for probation officers to, when they're notifying a school about a juvenile's disposition, they can now either send it electronically or by mail. So that's the simple change there. And then lastly, on page 4, on line 4.16 and 4.17, what we're doing is currently when a person is having a PSI done on a felony drug sale distribution of a controlled substance, the PSI is required to include a community impact statement describing the adverse social economic effects in the neighborhood and the like.
Representative Johnson, for the record, can you please tell folks what a PSI is?
So a PSI is a pre-sentence investigation that the probation officer completes as requested by the court.
All right. Please continue, Representative Johnson.
So the second change then is changing the shall to a may, so it's not a requirement anymore, but rather something that the probation officer may do. It puts in permissive language. And that, in sum, Madam Chair, is the bill.
Questions from members? Representative Paymar.
Ma'am, just so I'm clear, so you're talking about C here on the... I'm just trying to get all the shells and the maze that you've changed with the amendment straight.
Really, the only...
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The change would be on line 4.17.
Yes.
That shall... becomes a may.
That shall becomes a may.
Correct. And the one on 4.2 remains a shall.
Okay. So, Madam...
Representative Paymar.
So you are... Okay, so victim notification remains a shall.
That's correct.
Representative Johnson. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 1467, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Smith. Welcome to the committee, Representative Smith. The chair moves the House File 1609 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Division. Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, thank you, and thank you for the time. I would have a request that there be an additional oral amendment, and if you would hear me out, and I'd ask you to take it, and that would be on page 3, lines 18 through 23, dealing with immunity. I would ask the committee strike that section, as well as on page 1 in the title, on line 1.4, deleting the language establishing immunity from liability for board members. So I would request that the immunity clause be stricken and referenced on the first page as well.
The chair would move that motion to get the bill in the shape that the author would like it. Questions from members? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just want to give a brief set of remarks, and then Mr. Dolish, who is chair of the Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board, chair of FLAB, is here to fill out the bill and also answer any questions. The Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board was initiated and created in 2006 by this legislature to provide oversight and accountability to forensic labs, and also to recommend forensic analysis processing guidelines applicable to the DCA and other laboratories to conduct such analysis. This bill represents legislation approved and voted on by FLAB in February of this year. Very briefly, Madam Chair, Minnesotans have an interest in ensuring that our forensic samples are introduced to the courts untainted and professionally prepared. I would ask Mr. Dolish to describe the bill, and then we're ready for any questions.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, my name is Frank Dolish. I'm the chairman of the Forensic Lab Advisory Board. The bill does a number of things. In Section 1, it allows the board to employ an executive secretary or executive director. This would probably, would be a half-time position. Section 2 amends some of the responsibilities of the board. The primary changes are one, that now laboratories that operate in the state of Minnesota would have to be accredited. The second has to do with investigating negligence or misconduct and requiring those labs that are found to be negligent would pay for the cost of the investigation. Section 3 as an amendment regarding board investigations. Section 4 we took out. Section 5 has to do with when the reports become public. Section 6. Section 5 allows the board to contract for the development of a reporting system and investigations of negligence. Section 7 strikes an obsolete deadline that the board had. Section 8 requires the Department of Administration to provide office space as opposed to the Department of Public Safety. Section 9 are some definition changes in the bill that defines forensic laboratory. And then Section 10 has to do with the appropriation of the executive secretary in a report that is outlined as well.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Smith, I move your bill and I support it. I just sent my staff up. I had gotten a report saying that the federal government is starting to say that in order to not appear as a forensic lab, as if you have some bias, that they are actually recommending that oversight be kind of taken away, kind of at the state level even. And so I sent my staff to get a copy of the report for you to take a look at. As we consider what we should be doing with our forensic labs, we should be looking at what they may be requiring of us at the federal level. And if they're saying that the state can't be unbiased, it would be very difficult to believe then that local units of government could be unbiased. And so as this group moves forward, I hope they'll take a look at this report and make some recommendations to this legislature.
Madam Chair, we will review it, and as we go along in this area of science, all input is welcome.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, the Chair renews her motion that House File 1609 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion passed. Thank you, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is Representative Champion in the room?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Tamar, will you move Representative Champion's bill?
So moved.
All right, Representative Tamar moves that House File 545 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Champion.
And, Your Honor,
Your Honor, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
That's appropriate as well. Madam Chair, I also have an amendment that I would like to have moved as well.
All right. Representative Kamar moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion fails. Representative Campion.
And let me start this way. This particular bill is an important bill, needless to say, and I believe all bills are important, but of course it's important to me because it is one that I am the chief author of. This bill has the support of the Secretary of State's office, the Department of Corrections, as well as I got input from Representative Sheldon Johnson from a probation perspective, and that's why there is this amendment. Here's what this bill does. Number one, under Section 1, it just creates a duty for the Secretary of State's office to develop and complete information in a single publication about voting rights of people who've been charged with or convicted of a crime, and also for that to be available electronically. We also have someone here from the Secretary of State's office that I'm not asking to testify right now unless there were some other specific questions, but their office says that they support the bill and that they can accomplish this. Number two, if you look in Section 2, it is just asking that the Chief Executive Officer of each state and local correctional facilities to designate an official within the facility to provide notice and may also provide an application of one, an application where a person can register to vote if they have it available. But it's also my understanding from the Department of Corrections, who is also supporting the bill, and they indicated to me that they can do that, and they support the bill as well. You see, under Section 2, Subdivision 2, there's a notice requirement so that if a person, you know, if an inmate is being released from prison, and just so people clearly understand that a person can be released from prison and they have no probation time that they need to do, they serve all their time, and they can be released, and under the law right now, immediately their civil rights are restored to them. We are just asking that there be notice provided to them, and or a person who's gone through probation, and their termination date comes up. We just want that probation officer to send out a letter, as they usually do, with specific language so that it's uniformed across the state. You'll also see in Subdivision 3 is a form of notice. Now, we believe that this is very important so that everyone is saying the same thing. When they, you know, provide a letter or if they're talking to them, just provide the same information so that there's consistency. And finally, what I think is important, not just on the back end once a person is no longer on probation or parole, but also on the front end, I think that there's a notice notion that should be done as well. If you look under Section 3, all Section 3 does is, at the time any person is adjudicated guilty of or plead guilty to a felony level offense, we're just asking that when the court is already saying, for an example, you know, because you have been found guilty of or pleaded guilty to this felony level offense, that you can't possess a firearm, for an example. I just want the court to also say at that time, and you cannot vote until you are completely off probation and you serve all your time, so that there's no confusion. And so I wanted that just done on the front end, and the courts have indicated to me that that's no problem as well. So just on the front end and on the back end, so we don't have a problem with someone registering to vote when they shouldn't, and or a person feeling like they can, well, that they should be able to vote and not know that they can vote. So that's the bill, and I'll be willing to answer any questions, and I do have a testifier here who can kind of talk about the problems that he's seen with working for and with felons.
Representative Champion, I just want to confirm that this is just a notice of restoration of the civil rights and not a changing of when restoration is placed.
Absolutely. This is not a bill, just so that people are clear, this is not a bill that says before a person has paid their debt to society and that they're no longer on probation that allows them to vote prior to the civil rights being restored to them. This is not that bill.
All
if
right.
we do nothing, you know.
Except notification.
That's right.
Okay. Welcome, testifier. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
My name is Efren Maldonado. I'm a retired correctional officer. I was with inmates while in prison with them many, many years in informing them and helping them and directing them, even with goals and settings when they come out. One thing that was prevalent, there was continuously, is many, they never knew when if their votes were set back, I mean, I guess, given the right back to vote again. I also, when I retired, I started working with the Council on Crime and Justice, and so now I am a case advocate. This is them. This is those people that take our program. And to do some, 4 months before they come out, I do some goal setting for them and assist them on directing them with, for housing and employment and all that. But again, they don't know that they can vote. Now, because of the such a large group that we have coming out, I formed a group called Felons for Felons, which we have a big meeting every other 2 weeks, and also they come and see me and visit me. And I keep asking that, and this is one of the questions that I ask, and very, very few know about their voting rights reestablished. And I just feel that they should, I mean, we really let them know when they do something, when they go to prison for a crime they committed. We make it clear, we announce it, it's everywhere. But somehow, when they're finished with it, they're not really announced or given the credit that they pay their dues and what has been reestablished again for them.
Thank you. Is there questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Representative Johnson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Representative Champion for bringing this bill forward and is willing to work with probation to make the language work in a way that I think is going to be a workable piece of legislation. And I'll also state that this kind of legislation really fits with what we consider in probation to be best practices, specifically giving the offender a chance to get reintegrated into the community and feel like they have a piece of what's going on in the community and feel like they are have a part to take in it. So thanks for doing that.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Champion, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I know you and I talked about it before, and I like the bill. I want to support it. The part I don't like is the part where our government is being suggested to one audience or another to bring forward voter registration cards. And I realize that the amendment changed some of the nature of that. I'm wondering, as the author, if you'd be willing to remove the part that refers to voter registration cards. If so, I would be wholeheartedly, enthusiastically in support of this bill from here on forward.
Representative Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. I would trust that you will continue to be supportive of it, because by us changing the language and making it permissive and not an unfunded mandate, it just gives, you know, that added opportunity for anyone in the system to perhaps have some available. We are not requiring them to do so, and so I would hope that you'll continue to support it, because it's an important piece of legislation and it's good public policy.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Champion, I'm assuming that you're not interested in amending that portion out. Is that what you said?
Representative Champion.
Madam Chair, Representative, actually, no, I'm not interested in that, because I think it still allows us to go forward and it doesn't do anything that would be a negative. And the whole purpose is that we want to make sure that people know on the front end and back end of this process that they can vote. And when they cannot vote, for that to be clear as well.
All right. Representative Tamar renews his motion that House File 545, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Champion. Members, we have completed our business for today, and as of right now, there is no reason to meet on Tuesday. So this, at this point, is our last meeting. So I would like to thank the members for their participation. This has been a great session for this committee, and I appreciate all your hard work. Representative Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you for giving us a good lead in the way we handled the all the process here for public safety policy, and thank you for your generosity and your kindness to the minority.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. It has been a pleasure. So unless you hear from me, this meeting is adjourned, and it's our last meeting.